welcome to Tech Weekly. I'm Keith Stewart from the Guardian Games blog, and this week we've clambered onto the train and headed south to the Develop Conference in windy Brighton. Here, the movers and shakers of the video game industry gather every year for a packed programme of sessions covering everything from architecture in games to communicating with music artists. So, in this special video game edition of Tech Weekly, we'll be considering the current state of the UK games industry and looking at some of the most epoch-shattering new titles currently being developed on this fair isle. Throughout the programme, I'll also be interviewing every games industry power player that I can physically wrestle away from the complimentary buffet table.
None of the ruins are visible from down here. And if Father did explore this site, I see no sign of it yet.
I've already struck video game development gold. Joining me in the studio, or more accurately, my modest suite at the Hilton Metropole Hotel, are three well-renowned veterans of the UK industry. Firstly, David Braben, founder of Frontier Developments and co-creator of legendary 8-bit space trading game Elite. David, has there been anything that show that's interested you so far?
Well, I was very interested where you did a talk session with Dave Jones, and I learned a lot about the first GTA game back in 1997.
Okay. And Dave Jones, who you've introduced for me. Dave's here. He's the founder of Real Time Worlds and obviously previously founder of DMA Design, responsible for the blockbusting platformer game Lemmings and, of course, the original Grand Theft Auto. Dave, what have you seen anything interesting so far, apart from your own keynote speech?
No, I mean, it's still early in the day, but, you know, funnily enough, I just, you know, came back from trying to play Elite, actually, funnily enough, as well, and I just realised I wasn't hardcore as I thought. You know, so my skills have somewhat diminished over the years, I'm afraid to say.
Okay. And finally, we have Jonathan Smith, head of development at TT Games, the publisher behind the massively successful LEGO Star Wars, LEGO Indiana Jones, and LEGO Batman games. Jonathan, what have you seen at the event so far that's interested you?
I've had a brilliant time. I love coming to Brighton for this conference. And there's been some great stuff at the Evolve track of this conference. I was excited yesterday to see Christian from Playfish speak very dramatically about his vision for socially networked games. And today, at the risk of some mutual admiration, David's keynote, where he was exposing APB, was mind-blowing and brilliant.
Okay, thanks, guys. We'll be hearing more from you later. Also coming up, I'll be asking Jay Tidy and Darren Tucky from Relentless Software about their forthcoming episodic murder mystery game called Blue Toad Murder Files. I'll also be speaking to Ian Livingston, president of Eidos, about what the future holds for the company. And much, much more from the throbbing games industry gossip hive that is Develop Brighton. The UK games industry has been a major player on the interactive entertainment stage since the days of the BBC Micro and ZX Spectrum. But while Britain is regarded as a hotbed of creative talent, a decade of global consolidation has seen the country lose most of its games publishing power. Most UK development studios are now subsidiaries of, or work exclusively for, foreign-owned multinational corporations, including French giant Ubisoft, Japanese veterans Sega, Sony and Nintendo, and American corporations like EA, Activision and Microsoft. One of the latest British publishers to fall is Eidos Interactive. This 20-year-old tech company entered the games industry in 1995 and rose to prominence via the smash hit Tomb Raider series. But in 2005, the company was taken over by fellow British publisher SCI, and this February was bought by Japanese publisher Square Enix. Are you keeping up with this? 2 weeks ago, Square Enix announced that Eidos would become Square Enix Europe, with the name Eidos existing only as a game development brand. So is this symbolic of Britain's gradual loss of power in the games industry? Earlier today, I spoke to Ian Livingston, president of Eidos, and asked him to clarify exactly what's happening with Eidos and its new role within the Square Enix empire.
The facts of the matter is that, you know, the Eidos label will live on. So as far as the world's concerned, from all games from Eidos Studios, anything we sign from external studios, you'll see the Eidos logo plainly on the box, and in the loading screen you'll see the Eidos logo. So, you know, Eidos is a of course, a Square Enix company, but the Eidos label will live on.
What was it that Square Enix was attracted to Eidos for? What were they looking for in the purchase?
Well, Square Enix are looking to be a global publisher and developer. Clearly, they've got fantastic content that's been created in Japan, but it kind of pointed many towards the Japanese market. So they were looking to get a global reach and acquiring a company like Eidos, where we can offer original IP in company-owned studios around the globe. So it's Western IP aimed more at a more of a Western market is what attracted to them. They're not looking to take our IP and develop it in Tokyo. Far from it. The absolute opposite. They want us to build on our ability to make right IP for a Western market and perhaps a global market too.
What do you think the Eidos story over the last 5 years tells us about the British games industry?
The thing about the British games industry is we got off to an amazing start in the 1980s. Isn't it? So Clive Sinclair put affordable home computing into the hands of a very creative nation. So it's no surprise that games like Grand Theft Auto, Tomb Raider, Championship Manager, millions of titles have come out from the UK that have been of amazing quality. We're very, very good at creating original IP. What we're not so good at is hanging on to that IP. So we've got incredible creative talent who've never always seen eye to eye, innovators never seen eye to eye with investors. And I think there's been a disconnect with investors. There's been a skills problem. There's been an inability of government to support the industry. They've kept us at arm's length, really. There's been no production tax credits. The R&D tax credits has been very difficult to understand. The government has to put their arm round to support us, and yet, you know, you look at the sales of games, it's a $50 billion a year sales today, and expected to be $90 billion in sales by 2015. So it's an incredibly growing industry, and I think there's been a misconception about the type of games that people actually purchase. You know, only 3% of games carry an 18-plus rating. Most of games are suitable for family play. And I think people are beginning to understand that slowly because of the rise of the Wii and the Wii Sports, like people playing games together socially in the living room. So I'm kind of frustrated that, you know, we've not been able to hang on to some of our great British assets. You know, we're becoming a production company where we create great IP, but alas, we're foreign-owned in the main.
And is there a worry? You've said about how attractive Britain is as a kind of hotbed of creative talent, but also a lot of our talent are leaving and going to places like Canada where the standard of living and the pay are much better for games developers. Is there a worry that we're going to lose the kind of unique flavour of British games?
Well, the brain drain is certainly happening. If you're talking about Canada, now, the Canadian government took a view that, you know, video games as part of the creative industries, the knowledge economy, the future, as manufacturing is in decline and financial services is currently in disarray. And they made a conscious decision to invest $500 million in setting up an infrastructure for games companies to set up shop in Quebec, in Montreal primarily. They offered an ecosystem with universities, with the graduates that industry actually wanted, rather than some of the vocational courses that offered in the UK where they offer sort of generalist games degrees, but they can't actually code games. We need computer scientists, artists, and animators. But it's not just a handout as far as they're concerned. That $500 million of investment has actually led to $1.5 billion of inward investment as companies like Electronic Arts, Ubisoft, and Eidos have set up shop there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's proved to be cash positive for them.
Yeah, okay. What's happening next with Tomb Raider? There's been some rumours online that it's being reinvented as an open world survival horror game. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's happening with your?
Well, of course, we have got another Tomb Raider in the works, but nothing at all has been decided how she will appear in the next iteration. We're looking at a number of ideas, and we've been testing out those ideas, and some of those ideas have leaked onto the web, and but we're not at this point commenting on those because, you know. In fact, it's actually good in a way because we're getting reaction to those leaks on the web. So, you know, it's giving us a steer whether we wanted it or not. So it's interesting what people are saying.
Tomb Raider's an interesting game because it has kind of spanned its way across in a very important time in the industry. And I suppose now the value of that brand has almost been overtaken by modern brands. A lot of people seem to think of Tomb Raider as a kind of a 90s thing. How important do you feel it is to take in ideas from the wider games development environment, or do you have a very kind of introspective way of designing the Tomb Raider games?
Well, Lara Croft was originally released in 1996. The important thing for me is that she survived the test of time, rather like James Bond has survived over 40 years in cinema. And not all James Bond films have been great, and not all Tomb Raider games have been great. Let's be honest about that. You know, Angel of Darkness was not a particularly fine game, and but the fan base still love Lara Croft. So she's got massive intellectual property value. What we have to do is make sure that we create the right experience for new consumers of today. So through our R&D process at the moment, we're trying to find and explore new ways of giving all the positive attributes of Lara Croft to new and existing audiences.
Okay. Finally, if you could go back to Eidos when they first came to the games industry in, I think it was 1995, if you could go back there in time and give them one warning about what's going to happen in the future of the industry, what would you say?
I would say to look at the advance of the internet and web and the whole, not just distribution of games online, but playing games online. You know, there's just areas of game playing opportunities that now exist today that you wouldn't have dreamed back in about in the 1990s. But it's interesting to see that's almost gone back to its roots. And when Pong was released way back in the late 70s and during the early days of the 80s in the Atari, you know, there was about 40% recognition of games as an activity. And it kind of narrowed as games became more complicated. And some would say, you know, adding violence to them kind of narrowed it even further. But that niche was big enough to support the industry. Mm-hmm. And it's only with the rise of Nintendo's Wii games in particular that audience has suddenly grown again. And I find that, you know, particularly encouraging.
So that was Ian Livingston talking about the state of the British games industry and how essentially a lot of UK IP is now owned by large foreign companies. And Jonathan, you are head of development at TT Games. What's been your experience of working with large foreign companies and how has it affected development at Traveller's Tales?
We've always had a global outlook because our specialism has always been on licensed games, working with big entertainment properties often originating from North America. Our work on Lego properties also originates from an IP that's owned by an amazing Danish company. So while we've been proud to be British sort of at the coalface, the teams working in Manchester here in the UK, and proud to be part of a scene that's so creative and so lively, we've always... Our games themselves have always been positioned on a global stage. At the end of 2007, TT Games was purchased by Warner Brothers, obviously a North American company, and we've been right at home there. Ian's right to make the observation that Britain doesn't hold on to its valuable IP, and that is an issue for people to consider. But from our point of view and from our day-to-day experience as people who want to make great games that loads of people are going to play, Warner Brothers has been a fantastic place for us to do that.
Okay. And David, you have an independent game studio. Frontier Developments is independent. How does that work for you? Is that for you about maintaining your independence, or is it a financial thing? Is it a creative decision?
I think each of the different things, it sort of comes together in each of those separate fields. I mean, one of the things that you mentioned is, you know, hanging on to IP. And I think that's something that we have largely managed to do. Whether it's jointly owned with the publisher or whether it's wholly owned by us, you know, in terms of going sort of all the way back to games like Elite that we mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. you know, that because that's the key, that's our lifeblood. I mean, one of the problems with the UK is if you look at the, and I'm sure this is echoing some of the things that Ian has said, the games business is growing at a prodigious rate worldwide. You know, it's 20%+ every year on year. And yet in the UK, it's staying about the same and maybe arguably declining, depending on how you look at the forecast. And those people who are based in the UK, more and more are getting owned by the big foreign conglomerates, which it's one of those things that sort of in the very nature of globalization isn't something necessarily to be afraid of. Mm-hmm. But I think that the trouble in terms of looking where it places the UK in the future, where we've let other industries sort of go abroad in sort of other fields, this is something where Britain is right at the forefront. and it will be great if we can stay there. You know, I mean, to be honest, things are really good for us, you know, so that's hugely positive. We've published games ourselves, like Lost Winds, for example. Mm. But the point is that's done within a context that, you know, I absolutely want to stay here. It's just Britain isn't necessarily getting any easier as a place to base game development for a lot of reasons.
Dave, you're now working with, I think, with Electronic Arts mm-hmm. on APB, which is the game that you're working on at the moment. And you've been through a fair few takeovers in your time. Have you found that's kind of affected the culture of game development? Because at DMA Design, you had a very specific culture, I believe, of game development. It was kind of very experimental and kind of almost flying by the seat of your pants. But do you feel that has changed because of foreign companies coming in and trying to kind of pigeonhole the way you work?
No, I think that's just the way that the industry has evolved, and, you know, and the way budgets have evolved and team sizes have evolved. I mean, it's just very, very hard. You know, I mean, these are big, big production, you know, games now. And whereas before you could afford to take chances. You know, if your project was, you know, a year, 15 months for 12 people, you know, a company of 100 people, you could afford to be quite risky with some projects. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, basically, you know, companies like us only do one or two projects every 3 years. You really, you know, it's very hard to take risks of that kind of scale. Yeah. So in some respects, it is the nature of just the beast and the way that, you know, the market's evolved. Yeah. Luckily, I think we've got some new markets that can you start to look at, you know, innovation again. But it's a big industry now, and it's, you know, it's $20 million, $30 million budgets for these big games.
Yeah. Okay, we'll be right back with Dave, David and Jonathan in a little while. First, if you're craving a news fix from the wider world of technology, here's your tech dealer, Bobby Johnson, with some headlines.
Google is not liable for defamatory comments that appear in its search index, according to a High Court ruling. The case, brought by a London-based education and training group, alleged that Google was responsible for derogatory comments that appeared in internet searches, but a judge said the internet giant was merely a facilitator of information. Amazon has been accused of activities worthy of Big Brother after mysteriously deleting copies of George Orwell books that had been downloaded by owners of the company's Kindle ebook reader. The books had mistakenly been sold in breach of copyright, but customers were angered after the company remotely removed the books from their Kindles and then refunded them the cover price. After their failed courtship last year, Microsoft and Yahoo are said to be circling each other once again over a possible deal. Reports suggest that Microsoft could be willing to pay $3 billion for a slice of Yahoo's search business, a deal that Yahoo board member Carl Icahn has said he would back. And finally, a team of engineers in the US have been forced onto the back foot after some unusual claims about a robot they're building with help from the Pentagon. The Eater machine is able to power itself by devouring its surroundings, but despite reports suggesting that the robot could feast on dead bodies, its makers have gone on the record to say that it's a strict vegetarian.
Thanks, Bobby. And there's more news on the site all week at guardian.co.uk/technology. Of course, any video game conference, the real action happens at the bar. So I'm heading down there now to find out what the vibe is on the develop show floor.
Hi, it's Carrie Cunley from Game Horizon. I've come down to the develop conference to network, meet a few people, but I'm also here to kind of obviously listen to some of the speakers. Dave Jones from Real Time Worlds, he's got some really interesting, exciting stuff to talk about when it comes in down to kind of online games and looking at where they're heading. And also Kieran from Playfish, I heard a talk yesterday, he was talking about casual games, and that was really interesting. Within the games industry, we think of We kind of categorise games, whereas as consumers, they don't care what type of game they are, as long as we're having a really good experience.
Oh, hello, my name's Paul Barnett. I'm the creative director for BioWare Mythic, I was really impressed by that poor sod dressed as a robot at every coffee break. He was quite a laugh. There are three things that this place has done well. One has been explaining that disruptive technology, which sort of catches everyone flat-footed, that's like those iPod things and that Wii. The other one has been disruptive markets, people moving into, you know, micropayments and free-to-play and all this other stuff which confuses people. But most importantly, with all this information and all these heavyweights of the industry, we haven't got a Scooby-Doo clue where we're going in the next 5 years.
Hi, I'm Andrew Oliver from Blitz Games. We're showing off our Blitz Tech technology and the 3D TV support. We've had a big crowd of people amazed to see 3D TV for the first time, games running on Xbox and PlayStation 3. A very interesting thing came up earlier, saying that the 3D looks really cool, but what is the next step? Obviously, you start combining the 3D with things like Natel and camera recognition, you'll be able to see into worlds, look around objects. That's when it's going to be truly, truly holographic.
Mark Rain, Vice President, Epic Games. What I've learned at Develop is that more and more developers need to talk to us about using Unreal Engine 3 technology, especially in these economic times. Should come and talk to us. We can really help out a lot of great companies here in the UK. I'm not here on vacation, you know. I'm here to work.
So, with the games industry contributing many millions of pounds to the UK economy, is the government doing all it can to nurture the sector? Well, the short answer is no, not yet. TIGA, the national trade body representing game developers, is currently lobbying Parliament for more support, including the sort of tax breaks offered to video game developers in countries like Canada, France, and Singapore. To find out how that process is faring, I talked to Dr. Richard Wilson, TIGA's chief executive officer, and asked whether MPs are sympathetic to the cause or whether they think games are actually the spawn of Satan, played only by hoodie-wearing hoodlums.
We're working to influence government in two key ways. Over the last 2 months, I've met 10 different MPs, ministers, civil servants, to tell them about the importance of the games industry and to emphasise to them the need for a tax break for games production. We need a tax break for games production to enable the UK games industry to be even more competitive. The second thing I've been focusing on, which TIGA has been focusing on, has been to establish and to instigate the creation of an all-party group on computer games and the video game industry in the UK. The key thing we're trying to get forward, or the key message we're trying to get over to government, is the need for this tax break for games production, because all our key competitors offer tax breaks or very generous government support to their development sectors. Our sector is a success story, but with the right tax environment, we can be even more successful. We can be truly world-beating.
Obviously, one of the examples which is often brought up is Canada, where they offer quite certain areas of Canada offer very generous tax breaks. Do you see a future where Britain can compete with them on a similar level?
Although I'm an optimist, I don't imagine we're ever going to get the kind of tax breaks that the Quebec authorities have been giving to their games development sector. But I do believe we will get a tax break for games production because our arguments are convincing and the message we're bringing to government is a positive one, that our sector is successful. It's one of the sectors that should be helping to lead the UK economy out of recession. But the second thing we have to get right are skills. And so we're taking some actions ourselves. TIGA's become an awarding body for the train-to-game courses, and we work with universities to improve standards. But there's much more we can do. And one of the things we're arguing that government should do is to provide reductions in tuition fees for students who are studying computer science or mathematics at degree level to try and give a powerful incentive to students to study these very important subjects.
Yeah. One of the things we seem to be seeing at the moment with video game development in the UK is a loss of a traditional kind of publishing layer. Is there a danger that the UK is going to become a kind of outsourcing for creative content, and will we lose the individual flavour of British games as a result?
Well, I hope that won't be the case. Even if a large proportion of UK game developers end up working for overseas multinationals, I don't think that's necessarily a catastrophe, provided we are producing good quality games and the games businesses in question strike reasonable deals, good deals, with those overseas publishers. But of course, that's only one side of the equation. The other issue is that many UK game developers are looking seriously at self-publishing, publishing on the internet, which will enable them to go directly to market, which will put them in a very powerful position.
Yeah. It seems at the moment that the model is that self-publishing works for smaller, for much smaller games, and digital distribution doesn't seem to be at a stage where it can support enormous games, either technologically or the market isn't quite ready for that. And is there a worry then that British development is going to become skewed towards producing small casual games which can be released over things like PlayStation Network and Xbox Live? And are we going to lose that part of British development that works on massive games like Grand Theft Auto and Tomb Raider?
No, I don't think that will be the case, because in terms of specifically the self-publishing issue, I think you look at some companies like Jagex, who are clearly able to sell games and monetize the games very successfully to very large markets.
Yeah. Okay. Finally, one very quick last question. How receptive are the MPs that you've spoken to about games? Because often what we see is MPs criticizing games, getting on the back of big Daily Mail, ban this sick filth stories. You know, there was that awful Boris Johnson article a year or so ago. We often hear Keith Vaz criticizing games. So how receptive have politicians been to you, and are their attitudes changing?
Well, one of the things I'm absolutely delighted about over the last 18 months is the fact that we have managed to change the way MPs, and perhaps peers as well, perceive the video games industry. 18 months ago, 2 years ago, I think you're right, we were perceived in quite a negative way. I don't think that's the case any longer. The very fact that Tiger instigated the creation of an all-party group on computer and video games, the fact that we have about 20 MPs and some peers who are members of that video games group, shows that parliamentarians and politicians are receptive to what we're saying. And when I speak to front bench and opposition spokesmen and women, they are positive about the sector. They're familiar with the fact that the vast majority of video games are not sick filth and shouldn't be banned by the Daily Mail, because that in a sense would be the banning body. They're much more perceptive than that. I was very impressed, for example, that when Tiger gave evidence to the House of Lords Communications Select Committee, that had people from who previously been cabinet ministers on that select committee. They were very well informed, and they were pretty positive about the sector, actually, and which is why I'm pretty optimistic. There's still some arguments we've got to put forward. We've still got to get some evidence to convince the government this is the right thing to do. But I think politicians on both sides of the House are receptive to our message.
I'm Dave Thompson, I'm Dinky's number one fan. What I've learned to develop so far is that there is somebody who understands the concept of the long tail, and that guy's Dave Edery, who used to be at Microsoft. He did the closing keynote on the Evolve, and he actually explained to everyone what the real concepts of the long tail are and why there are so many myths and misunderstandings in the games industry. People think that there's the chance to sell all these little niche products and stuff, but actually the long tail still relies on having blockbuster hits, and it really only makes a lot of sense if you're an aggregator rather than an individual developer.
Hi, I'm Alison Beasley from Lincoln Beasley PR. The thing that really surprised me today was during a session with David Braben and Dave Jones, and they were both talking about the titles they made years ago, Elite and GTA. And what really, really surprised me was how pretty much 90% of the audience had played both of those games and were still really enthusiastic, and just the level of passion that they felt for those games.
My name is Ian Simons, I'm the director of the Game City Festival and also work on the Astro Video Game Archive. Develop has been fantastic today so far. The event I just came out of with Martin Hollis, talking about the generation of the Bonsai Barber WiiWare game, which isn't something we've played in Europe yet. I was really looking forward to playing it. And it was a kind of common thread. He was talking about something that Genova Chen from that game company was kind of alluding to earlier on today. This whole kind of idea of listening to the emotional heart of a game. They're using the sort of language that I guess kind of novelists almost and filmmakers and songwriters use. And kind of how brutal you have to be to kind of reach that in terms of throwing away things that are extraneous to it. So that was fantastic. It was like listening to David Lynch talking about a video game that he just made, and frankly delivered in a not dissimilar way. And that's a compliment.
Hi, I'm Margaret Robertson. I run a game consultancy company called Lookspring, and I work with game developers and publishers to help make sure their games come out well. The single biggest thing that I've learned at this year's Develop is that iPhones aren't waterproof, particularly when you drop them down toilets. The second most interesting thing I've experienced here probably was a conversation that I had with Lego, Star Wars and Batman and Rock Band and everything else's Jonathan Smith about the death of the video game console and whether or not it's been gravely exaggerated. And in the end, we drew some very interesting conclusions about what platform you need to be developing on for 5 to 10 years' time. But I won't tell you what that is, because both of our fortunes depend on it.
Once upon a time, video games were mostly linear in structure. You had a place to start a level and a place to end it, and the player was subtly or unsubtly funneled between the two positions. The Grand Theft Auto series is widely credited with kickstarting the open world genre, but games like Assassin's Creed, Fallout 3, and more recently Sony's sci-fi thriller Infamous have added to the recipe, with advanced AI enemies able to learn from and predict player behaviours, and also destructible scenic objects allowing the player to effectively modify the environment. But where is the open world concept going, and what will it mean for traditional elements such as narrative and grand action set pieces? David, some say Elite was the precursor to the open world idea, and now you're working on The Outsider, which is a big open world espionage thriller. Are there elements of the Elite game design that are still relevant today?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the fact that something's open world is not so much what's important. It's the freedom. The ability to go in any direction liberates the player from having to, what amounts to following a script, and if you've got a prescriptive level-based game, which is very restrictive, especially if either you don't get what it is you're trying to do or it's too much of a challenge. But also, you know, you're playing games to have fun. So there is something really nice if you have discovered something rather than you have been told to do it and then you've just managed to do it. So I think that I would say much more it's the freedom, and one of the elements of freedom is the openness of the world. Mm-hmm. But that, yes, I agree. I think it is a very important thing. And that certainly when with Elite, that was the intention.
And Dave, with APB, which is going to be available on PC, you're doing something quite different with the whole idea of open worlds, because the game itself is going to exist on a server, isn't it? And even if you're playing, even if you want to play by yourself, you still go into the server game. But you can also play against other people. Could you explain briefly how APB is going to work in that sense?
Well, basically, it's building an open world game. But at the end of the day, you know, to go along with open world, you really want, you know, open world AI, as I call it, and it's what we call players as content. So rather than trying to, you know, do, you know, amazing AI, which to be honest is still, you know, years and years and years and years away. I mean, human emotions and just human nature are just so much more fun to play with. I mean, that's what makes any kind of gaming social fun, you know. So we try to do is create an experience where, okay, you know, we can build this big open world game, we can host it on a server, and because of that, you know, we can bring 100 players into this open world game. And then it's their interactions with each other that really, you know, define the game.
Okay. And Jonathan, with the Lego games, although they do have, I suppose, more of a traditional structure, they're not exactly linear. There's some kind of sense of exploration for the gamers, which obviously ties in with the sandbox nature of playing with Lego. But do you see that kind of diversifying in the future of the Lego franchise?
There's a problem with terminology. Any game that I've ever loved is an open world game, but that includes platform games like Mario and Yoshi's Island as well. If it wasn't, what's the alternative to being an open world, a closed world, a game where you're just running down a corridor and you can't go anywhere and you can't make any choice and you're not free at all?
Medal of Honor, for example.
there are examples. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we at its simplest level for Lego Star Wars, not to draw too direct a comparison with those amazing Nintendo games, we did quite specifically give you the choice to play three episodes in parallel and switch between them all. However, the consideration for us working with a younger audience, in contrast to an expansive city environment, is to make sure that young players who can be intimidated by a world which can overawe them also have a very clear directive step by step.
Because I guess for everybody around the table, that maybe is hard for developers to almost to let go of the kind of didactic world where you're saying to the gamer, these are your tools, this is the level in front of you, now go and do this. And Dave, in your keynote this morning, you showed a video of people online, a YouTube video, people playing Crackdown and, mm-hmm. and doing all sorts of their own things, like throwing people off of bridges and setting up cool car stunts. And this happens quite a lot. I mean, it sounds as if that will be an exciting for developers, but also surely it must be kind of almost intimidating, thinking, what the hell are people going to do with this world once I've created it?
And they don't have to do that. I mean, that's a great thing. I mean, that's just one style of game. There will always be a great market, you know, for great storytelling, you know, really well-scripted, you know, games that unfold as you play them. Mm-hmm. But I want to continue playing games like Half-Life, etc., you know, because they are tremendous. So it's just about, you know, you're making sure that, you know, there are other genres out there. And yes, it is scary, and that's what makes it difficult, but that's what makes it exciting as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you have no idea what these people are going to do. So, you know, it's just approaching it, and, you know, from a different mindset and saying, well, you know, these kind of worlds are very hard to build because of that. But that's not going to stop us.
Yeah. Are there new sciences of storytelling that you're exploring with The Outsider? Because The Outsider is in a kind of an espionage thriller based in a large living universe. But it seems to be clear from what I've heard of the game that there is a strong kind of narrative. I mean, are there new methods of storytelling you're having to found with the game?
That might be too sort of putting too much of a claim to it, but essentially yes. I mean, the I remember mentioned Lego Star Wars, the original Star Wars film, which I absolutely loved. You know, you look back at the story of Star Wars, and the ordering of events doesn't really matter. It's the world that you remember, and that's because it wanted to be immersed in the world. And it's more like the campfire storytelling mechanic than what's been cemented by books and film, the strictly linear storytelling mechanic. So I think who does what to whom type of thing is actually less important. It's the fact that they're doing it and the fact that you can be involved.
Yeah. And Jonathan, with the Lego Star Wars games, talking about immersion into the world, at some point they want to be involved in Star Wars, but obviously it's a Lego rendering of that universe. How does that change the experience for them?
I think it changes everything. It changes the whole attitude in which you approach the world, because it now becomes a world of play. It becomes a world that's there for you to mess with and to create your own stories in, where those characters that you've loved, that have fired your imagination, that you have an emotional relationship with, are present, but they're present for you. You're not there to watch them, which is an amazing experience, but it's a different experience. They are there for you to play with. And that's the essence of a Lego world, and that's why the idea of making a Lego game was so appealing. And I think that's the essence of why it has been appealing to a wide audience. There are lots of other things, you know, that we've worked hard to create, but so much of it is determined by that starting premise, that a Lego world is there for you to play with.
I must say, when I first saw Lego Star Wars, I thought it was genius, because it disarms a lot of the... It means you can do such outrageous things, which actually, you know, like smashing another character to a load of Lego bits... without it feeling problematic, if you know what I mean.
Exactly. And the first meeting, going to Lucasfilm and saying, well, because you can mix up characters, because that's what we want to do, that's fun, that's brilliant, you can do that in games, you can do that in Lego games, would it be okay if you could have three versions of Darth Maul fighting each other in a film setting when he was actually dead? And I think there was a sort of a moment, and then, you know, they said yes. But Lego has given us permission to be able to do things with stories and characters and brand holders that I think, you know, people would have found difficult. But maybe it's a bit more acceptable now. People see what you can do in a game. So in terms of playing with brands and characters, I think Lego set some good precedents there.
But I think also to do you and Lucasfilm huge credit, that what they let you do with their very precious brand was very courageous before it went to market. But I just imagine the presentation, it required someone with some imagination to be on their end of it.
Absolutely. We were incredibly lucky and grateful to them. But there is a point about Lego being a device for sort of creating and playing with stories that speaks to the prevalence on YouTube, for example, of animations using Lego, stop motion animations, as being one of the dominant forms of expression and parody. I think there's no coincidence. There is a relationship there between what the idea of Lego enables you to do in your imagination, the fact that it's so often acted out as a play with stories there.
Yeah. I'm interested, Dave, as well, talking about this sense of kind of user generation. In APB, you're talking about the player creating an entirely individual character for themselves, and not only will they be able to change their clothes and give them tattoos, but in the game world, we're going to get to the stage where absolutely every single character looks different. That's what you're aiming for. And also people will be able to apply their own sound effects to certain areas of the game. So in a sense, do you think the player is almost becoming the brand? Each player is becoming their own kind of franchise within this game's world.
I mean, that's our ultimate goal, you know, is you know, for players to actually feel they're celebrities in, you know, in their own game, and to really, really push that. I think that's a strong mechanic, you know, because you know, it's just, you know, playing to, you know, what people are now expecting in their life with the web, etc. Everything is personalization. It's about them. It's about, you know, TV's going that way. Everything's going that way, you know. So first of all, it was, you know, open world game, control, do what they want. Now it's about putting them in the world and for them to project exactly the image they want into the world as well.
Okay. So final question, really, open question, and an obvious one to end on. What are open world video games going to look like in 5 years?
In 5 years. It's not a long time, actually.
Yes, it comes frighteningly quickly. I think the important thing actually is not what they look like, because I think we're reaching a sort of an asymptote in terms of the look is no longer what's driving games, I think it would be fair to say. I mean, the look will get better, but I think it's probably much more important to say, what is the feel? What is the atmosphere? What is my involvement? And I think that those are the fronts that I imagine most likely that we'll be pushing on. Certainly those are the fronts we're pushing on today.
Well, there's a key issue there about how closely integrated any virtual world is with your real social world. I know, David, when you've spoken on APP, how you'll be able to integrate your own music library and, or not literally share tracks, but share the experience of listening to the music that you're listening to with other players. As you see more close links between your social network relationships and the world, as those virtual worlds almost become more real and the mm-hmm. two become more closely linked, that's definitely going to be a new kind of experience.
Okay, so we've wandered a few doors down to the illustrious Grand Hotel here on the seafront at Brighton, and I'm joined by Jay Tidy, the producer, and Darren Tuckey, the senior producer of Blue Toad Murder Files, which is a recently announced game from Relentless Software. Relentless are kind of best known for the Buzz series of family quiz games, but this is a whole new series. And so, Jade, could you tell us a bit how the game came about?
We have like a company offsite to come up with some ideas every now and again, and we had one last summer, and we get everybody together, separate them into separate little groups, and just get them to start coming with ideas of things that they enjoy, things they'd like to play, and came through that lots of people were coming up with this kind of murder mystery type game. So we decided to start putting together some prototypes.
Dan, is it kind of, I mean, Buzz was sort of like, almost like Trivial Pursuits, but interactive and on a screen. So is this almost like a Cluedo type experience? Or
Cluedo's quite sort of a kind of a logic puzzle, really. We were kind of looking to recreate the kind of experience that people are used to with seeing TV shows like Midsummer Murders, Agatha Christie type stuff, where there are witnesses, alibis, motives. So more that kind of style than actual just kind of, was it in the drawing room with the candlestick or something like that. So.
Okay. And is it a multiplayer game? Do you sit on the sofa and play it with your family, or is it a single player thing?
It's 1 to 4 players.
Okay.
So, but equally, you can just have fun on your own, or with friends, kind of going through the story. So.
The great thing about Buzz was it was a really simple interface. You didn't really have to know loads and loads of buttons or anything like that. This is a different sort of thing. It's not being released into the shops, is it? It's digital distribution.
Yeah.
So are you still kind of keeping that idea of very simple controls and very easy user interface?
Yeah, you should be able to pick up and play. We don't want there to be a barrier for people coming into the game. Because we've tried to kind of mimic what you'd get in a TV series, you can sit down and you can watch the telly without really having to learn that much, switch it on, change the volume. So yeah, we want a similar thing with the game.
And Darren, it's episodic, isn't it? So
it is.
What led you to that model, and what benefits does it offer to you as a game developer?
Bite-sized chunks of gameplay. Mm-hmm. It also kind of reflects the kind of murder mystery kind of TV shows where you actually have an episode that's a start and an end, so it kind of worked well with that. And I think people can make a decision as to sit, if they're going to sit down and play a game when it's of a certain size.
Jade, this is going to be essentially published by Relentless as a digital product, and this seems to be something that other British developers are doing as well. In say 3 or 4 or 5 years time, do you think people are going to be buying most of their games as digital downloads, or do you think it's very much going to be the retail business for a few more years yet?
Yeah, I don't think buying stuff from the shops will go away. People like to have a physical object to unwrap, but I do think it's going to become a lot more popular. It's people are getting used to buying things like clothes and doing their food shopping online, and it's starting to become more popular in games now, and I think it's going to become massive in the next few years.
Okay. And Darren, just for developers, do you think this might become a model that smaller developers or even larger studios might be able to use these kind of smaller digital distribution products as a way of kind of experimenting with new ideas and trying out new stuff they'd never be able to do with a big PS3 or Xbox release? Do you think this is going to become quite common?
Yeah, I think it's worked for us. You kind of got a flexible price point. You can you can try some ideas and some experiments out on a smaller title that you probably wouldn't want to risk, with a full Blu-ray or something. So, I think there's room for both. Certainly for trying out, you know, new ideas and maybe going for something a little bit riskier, then it works very well.
So, thanks to today's guests, Ian Livingston, David Braben, Dave Jones, Jonathan Smith, Dr. Richard Wilson, Jade Tidy and Darren Tuckey. It's been a fascinating 3 days here at the Develop Conference. Now I'm off to promenade along the seafront, getting sticky candy floss fingers all over my Nintendo DS screen. Let us know what you think of today's discussion though. You can grab us on the blog, our Facebook wall, or drop us a tweet. The links are all at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. This has been Keith Stewart from the Guardian Games blog. Thank you very much for listening.